and welcome to Style Points. Today, our guest is going to talk to us about her experience doing volunteer anesthesia in environments where resources are particularly scarce. Dr. Erica Alcibiade, who once told me to pronounce her name using the letters L, C, B, A, and D, is an assistant professor of anesthesiology and former chief resident of our program here at the University of Cincinnati. After graduation, she did her fellowship in regional anesthesiology and acute pain medicine at Johns Hopkins before coming back to our group at UC. When she isn't practicing aerial yoga, she's planning her next trip to some amazing locale where she takes pictures of herself eating snacks next to a waterfall. Erica, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
So I've got a question for you, which is pretty commonplace at this point. I've asked it to many, many people over time, but it's our dinner question. So if you could have dinner with anyone in the world, could be somebody from the past or even from fiction, who are you having over for dinner and why?
I've always traditionally been really bad at answering this question.
You know, all of my guests say the exact same thing. So I'm interested in your bad answer as well.
But I have two and I can't decide which is the more accurate answer. So I'm going to give you both.
Excellent.
The first is my grandfather on my dad's side. He passed away when my dad was a teenager and came over to the U.S. from Italy. So I feel like he would have some really cool stories, both about, you know, family and some historical stuff. So I think that would be really cool to find out and figure out, you know, what terrible things my dad was doing as a teenager.
So you could use it as blackmail against him.
Exactly.
Excellent.
And then my other answer is John Muir, because I love doing the national parks and outdoorsy stuff. And I think he would have some really cool stories about what he saw that used to exist prior to everything becoming modernized.
That makes a lot of sense. And that sort of plays into what we're going to talk about today, which is essentially you being a world traveler and somehow turning that into something that you can do at work as well as on your own free time. So let's talk about that. How did you get into doing what it is you do?
So I wish I had a, you know, great story, but it's just kind of a culmination of everything that I love to do. As you mentioned, I love to travel and I always knew I wanted to take care of resource limited areas. I went to medical school in East Tennessee, where there is not a whole lot of rural medicine population being taken care of. So we used to do clinics for them and just combining some of the things that I love. International mission trips have become something that I am super passionate about. It's one of the reasons that I did a regional and acute pain fellowship. I want to be able to, you know, teach regional in resource limited areas, places where general anesthesia is not necessarily safe, that people can have surgeries with much less risk.
So is regional safer somehow than general anesthesia? Let's walk through that.
Yeah. A lot of the studies that look at resource limited areas and anesthesia show that there's just not well-trained anesthesia providers, and in some areas, not anesthesia providers at all. So managing airways and respiratory status is one of the leading causes of morbidity in these areas. So if you can avoid needing to manipulate an airway and knock out someone's arm or leg or, you know, whatever it is that they can have surgery comfortably without needing general anesthesia, it can actually be much safer for them in the long run.
So that's what inspired you to do your fellowship?
It did.
How was your fellowship geared towards that? What sorts of techniques, things did you learn? Did you gain expertise in that made this easier for you?
One of the reasons I chose to go to Hopkins for fellowship was because they have a lot of global connections already. And I had asked during my interview process about the ability of spending my elective time doing mission trips and doing global health work. And they were very supportive of it. Although they didn't have a program involved for regional at the time, they were very supportive in figuring out how I could do that. And I was actually able to spend 2 weeks in Ghana and another week in Uganda during fellowship, both on regional based trips, one through ASRA and another through another local group that one of the surgeons that we worked with was involved in. So I got to go and do and teach blocks and be really involved in kind of more a regional focused trip rather than a general anesthesia focused trip. So it was really cool to see all of that.
I had the privilege of being an attending while you were here in training, and I remember you as a trainee. And you were always somebody who was really steady and good with blocks and good with your needlework. So I think it surprised some of us when we thought about you doing a regional fellowship, but that makes it make a lot more sense for me, at least in my mind, why you would want to do a regional fellowship. It wasn't necessarily that you needed any extra skills with a block needle, which again, you were always great at, but more about gaining a global perspective on things.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a large part of, you know, doing the fellowship, learning how to kind of teach these things better to trainees that, you know, have never done a block, have never even seen an ultrasound in some of these locations.
So let's talk a little bit more about what you do as part of your work here in all these different countries. Do you have some different buckets that you like to put things into?
Yeah, every trip's a little bit different. You know, there's teaching trips, there's doing trips, there's, you know, educational things. So here at UC, we have two trips that we have gone on multiple times. One being started by Mike Howershuck, with Partners for Medical Relief in Belize. That is more of a doing with a slight component of teaching trip that we regularly take residents on. That is more of a general anesthesia type trip. It's mostly with ENT surgeons and general surgeons. So it just leads to, you know, more general anesthesia happening for those type of procedures. And then in Uganda, it's kind of a combination of both doing and teaching, which is another trip that Josh Truster had gotten involved in with one of our surgeons, Dr. Zender, with his nonprofit. So that's a little bit more doing and teaching simultaneously. They tend to bring trainees from all over the country to the hospital that we happen to be at so that their trainees can learn from us. And they have anesthesiologists as well as what they call medical officers there, which kind of function similar to how we think of like CRNAs and AAs here. But a lot of them practice a little more independently just because of lack of providers throughout the country.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about sort of start to finish, what one of these trips looks like, generally speaking. I'm sure that with these longstanding trips, you have a date in mind that you're going to go. What does all the logistics look like between having the idea and actually going and doing?
There's a lot that goes into it that, you know, people don't necessarily think of or recognize. Mike has got me a lot more involved in the planning stages of the Belize trip. I'm actually now on the board of Partners for Medical Relief and I'm involved in a lot of their planning and logistics and
that's amazing.
Figuring that out. So, you know, things from ordering medications, ordering supplies, what do we think we'll need? Who's coming with us? How do we get everyone there safely? You know, most of these countries, whenever medical trips come in, go through the supplies that you're bringing in, make sure they're not expired, make sure that they're things that are safe that they would use on their patients, which is totally appropriate. But it's common questions that I get here is, hey, we have all this stuff expiring. Can we just give it to you for a mission trip? And while I wish we could take it, the answer isn't always yes. So it's just little things like that. How do you have a big enough team? How do you account for if somebody gets sick, making sure you have, you know, a backup plan in that scenario? If someone can't go last minute, if a flight gets delayed, what medicines do you want to have with you? What medicines can you readily obtain and take into places? Obviously, we're not going to, you know, buy fentanyl off the street and take it down to a foreign country with us. So that's something we have to rely on getting there and knowing, you know, their health system can help us as well. So making connections within whatever city, hospital system, even government that you're, you know, going through can really help safely get your group there, do the work that you need to do, connect with the people you want to educate.
I don't actually have any personal experience with buying fentanyl off the street. And I hadn't ever thought about the logistics involved with getting controlled medicines in a foreign country.
Yeah.
How do you send an email? How does that work? How do you start to think about obtaining something like that?
Yeah. In Belize, which is where I have like the most experience, you know, getting kind of the medications and the involvement in that is we actually use the hospital system that we work through is narcotics. So we have what we lovingly call the drug lady. And she comes every morning with a locked box that has fentanyl and morphine in it, as well as usually a couple of pills and things that they can, like codeine, Tylenol number threes, that they can send patients home with if they so desire. And we sign it out from them. And at the end of the day, she comes back around and takes whatever vials are unused and documents it in her book and puts how many milligrams each patient got and who it went to. And they're all the glass ampules. So one of the big things I have to teach trainees is not to throw that glass ampule in the sharps bin because she wants it back. She wants proof that that is gone. So many times trainees are digging with, long forceps or something to get a fentanyl vial out of the sharps container. So that's always a learning curve.
That sounds actually like a more intensive wasting process than I maybe would anticipate for that sort of environment.
In Africa, the experience I've had is just one of the other providers gets it and we use it. I don't know what waste process we go through there.
Well, that makes sense. Okay, so what other supplies do you need for a trip like this and how does one obtain those things?
A lot of it is, things that we think of as, disposable, reusable things, endotracheal tubes, needles, syringes, oral airways, just anything you would think of for a normal anesthetic, even IVs and tubing. And typically we don't take fluids with us because they're heavy. That's something else we buy from their hospital system to use just because it's hard to ship.
Sure, that makes sense.
Fluids. But we'll often take the medicines with us and things. There are a couple of places within the city that do, donation-based things that people can donate from hospital systems. There's Matthew 25 Ministries, and then there's a place down in Louisville, whose name I can't remember currently, but they get a lot of medical supplies and you can send them kind of a wish list or go dig through some of their bins yourself. And then they are able to, you buy it for a very cheap price in comparison to what you would buy on like the medical market to take with you.
So are you packing that all into a checked bag? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Checked bags. Or duffel bags or whatever, you can get. This last trip to Belize that I went on, the first week where we take down a majority of the supplies, the second week they bring, some more supplies, but a lot of the stuff goes down the first week just to make sure we have everything that we need. I think we had 75 checked bags that were going with us.
Whoa. Are you carting these through the airport? How's this work? Are you taking multiple trips from your car?
It's a big group. They have people, there's somebody's house, a couple houses that do the packing of the supplies, and then they tell people, hey, start coming to pick up checked bags. So people will stop by all these, different people's houses and pick up bags, and it's your responsibility to get them to the airport. And they check you in one big group and scan them all through. And somehow I got involved in that process last year. So I was, handing passports back to everyone and counting bags and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. So it was kind of cool to be on that side of things, but it was definitely very labor intensive.
I would hate to be behind you in line.
Oh, yes.
At the airport.
They specifically gave us our own ticket counter and made everyone else go elsewhere.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine that. Is that a situation where they sort of know that you're coming and are doing this? Or is it just you show up and they're like, oh, great.
Probably a little bit of both. I know Mr. Kirby that organizes the tickets and that kind of stuff had messaged American back and forth about some of the logistics and getting, some approvals for free bags just since it was a mission trip and that kind of stuff. So they had maybe an idea, but I doubt the ticket counter realized that that was happening until we showed up.
Okay, so you've packed all of your drugs and equipment. You've gotten on the plane. I assume that you're massively jet lagged. You get there, then what? What happens?
Well, kind of depends, which trip it is. The Belize trip is about a 2-hour drive from the airport to where we're actually going to be working. The Uganda trip, which is my next most frequent trip, is about an hour from the airport. So you have to wait for all of those 75 or however many bags you're checking to come through the terminals, put them all on the thing, load them up into vans. 12 passenger vans are typically what we travel in.
Oh, wow.
So however many of those you need for however many people are going. Belize, we often have like 6-12 passenger vans packed full of people and bags on the way up to Corozal, where we typically are based. So you land, you wait for everyone to get their stuff, personal bags and all the checked equipment bags. If somebody goes and gets the vans, I don't take responsibility for driving those. That seems like too much for me.
that was going to be my next question. Are you driving?
Someone from the trip is. I have yet to volunteer for that that role, but
you do all the other stuff. You don't need to drive the van.
Yen Shay once made me bounce my head off of the ceiling when I was sitting on the floor of the back of the van. So that was on purpose, but you know.
Excellent. Well, I imagine when you're packed in tight with all those 75 bags, it's probably inevitable.
Yeah. Flat tire the last time we were driving to the hospital in one of those vans. So that was fun.
Okay. So tell me the flat tire story then.
There's, you know, six white vans just following each other. And all of a sudden we see like some smoking coming from the one. And we're like, oh, what's going on? And they pull off and we realize they have a flat tire. So everyone just kind of, you know, files off to the side of the road since we're traveling in a large caravan. And I didn't know this, but apparently there's spare tires like tacked up to the bottom of a lot of these vans. But between, I think, four vans, we could only find one tire that A, we could get off, or B, that wasn't also flat and destroyed. So they sent a bunch of us on our merry way. They sent another van from the rental company up to meet them, and they eventually made it to the hotel and the hospital.
Excellent. Okay, so you get there to the area where the hotel and the hospital is. Hmm. What does that hospital operating room look like? How is it different from what we have here?
So the hospital that we go to in Belize is the like Corazal Hospital. It is in northern Belize and just across the Mexico border. The system or the hospital that we typically do our surgeries in there is does not have functional operating rooms unless a team is there volunteering. So they are just used for volunteer teams. About 45 minutes away is a city called Orange Walk, where they do their actual surgeries for that area, which I actually personally haven't been to, but some of our other colleagues have been there. They've done surgery there in the past, just depending on what's going on. So I've never seen those operating rooms, but the ones in Corazal, there's two ORs that we use. You know, they're big white rooms with whatever equipment that people have left behind. Our group has actually found, I don't remember where they came from, but had donated had anesthesia machines donated in the last couple of years. So they're actually newer than the ones that I started going there with. Mike knew very well how to use the, I believe he calls them narcomeds, machines that are sitting now in the back hallway that we use as a display for the residents when they come down to see what anesthesia machines used to look like. But now we have some more updated equipment. There's, you know, a hospital bed or OR bed in each one that is not electronic. It does not go up and down most of the time. It has a foot pedal to raise and lower that might work sometimes. So you're kind of just working with the equipment that is readily available.
When you were using those older machines back a few years ago, what were some of the biggest differences between those machines and maybe the slightly more updated machines we have here?
Definitely the CO2 absorbent was different. It was just one of those ones that you dumped pellets in rather than had the exchangeable canisters that we now take down with us for, you know, the trips. But it was just a very saturated CO2 absorbent. So you never really knew exactly when your gas was going to wear off. The gas analyzer was a little questionable. The machines also progressively the screen that showed like the tidal volume and your minute ventilation and that kind of stuff throughout the week that I was there as a resident when Chris and Mary were there also just progressively kept getting blacker and blacker up the screen as the week went on. So at the end of the trip, you could only see where it said the date and time, which wasn't accurate anyways.
I would imagine that would be the least helpful thing to know is the date and time when you're trying to anesthetize somebody.
Yes.
So what we're dealing with is doing anesthesia in this completely resource limited environment. What else besides the machine being a little out of date is different?
Yeah. So with Belize, we take pretty much everything with us. So we're able to tailor it a little bit better to what we're more used to here in the US. You know, we take the meds that we can get with us. Some of the things that are harder to get, obviously the controlled substances. For whatever reason, it's hard to get phenylephrine ordered, but we can usually get ephedrine ordered, which is wild to me considering it's a controlled substance here in Ohio, but it's not everywhere. Just knowing what meds you have, how much of those meds you have, because it's a finite resource. However much propofol you take with you is how much you have available for that week or 2 weeks, depending how long you're going for. also sizing of things. You know, we can take a bunch of endotracheal tubes down, but if we end up doing a bunch of peds and only have a few ped sized things, you know, you can't do any more peds safely. So just different things to plan for. And we have a colleague down there that has a basement, which is apparently rare in Belize, but he keeps a lot of equipment in his basement for us that he brings up in a trailer every time we come to visit. So we have a lot of disposable supplies kind of tucked away in there so that we know we have some endotracheal tubes and things like that left there. And we donate a lot of it to their local teams as well. Whenever they ask for certain supplies, that way we can always bring more the next time.
What about monitoring? Are your monitors significantly different than we use here?
I wouldn't say significantly different, but intermittently functional might be a correct wording. In one of the ORs, we use two different monitor screens to get all of the vitals we are used to having. I think one of them has the blood pressure, one of them has the pulse ox and end tidal. And I don't remember which has the EKG on it, but we have to use two different monitor screens and two different sets of cables to get the appropriate vitals that we would normally have here during surgery. We also have portable monitors out in PACU. There's four PACU beds, but it kind of just depends on, you know, as a patient is waking up more, sometimes that monitor shifts to the patient that's just coming out. That's, you know, if someone's awake and talking, they're probably more fine than the person that's still, you know, just coming out of general. So you have to kind of allocate your resources and prioritize your resources as needed.
So tell me a story or two about some different situations that you've been in while you're there that required a different plan than you would have maybe done if you had more unlimited resources like you have here.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, different scenarios where you just kind of have to be adaptable and figure out what their norm is. On my trip to Ghana, which I said was more regional focused, we spent most of our time in their, what they call their accident and emergency operating theater, which is a lot of orthotrauma and a lot of kind of trauma-based surgeries that come in through their ER. And again, it's relatively unsafe to do general anesthesia in a lot of these places. So we'll never forget this little 8-year-old girl who had broken her arm in a, you know, motorcycle accident. And she was tearful, but, you know, in good spirits. And they did a nerve block on her. They did an infraclav block on her. No sedation, no warning, you know, just poking her with a needle, and she's crying, screaming through it. But in the operating room, she is wide awake, singing along to the music. And, you know, they let her pick the music. And in the US, an 8-year-old awake for surgery, awake for a nerve block, is unthinkable in most places. So just kind of seeing that and realizing, oh, like, this is real different than what I would see at a children's hospital at home, was one of those moments that I was like, oh, okay.
I have a 7-year-old who I consider to be a reasonably tough kid, but would he be okay with getting a completely unsedated infraclav? I don't think so.
Right. And infraclavs are like sensitive too.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, she was small, but like, you know, you got to go through some muscle to get there.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Another time that I had to definitely change my anesthesia plan, Derek Florence and I went on a trip to Uganda with Chad and his group a couple years ago. And we actually decided we were going to stay for a safari. So we flew separately from the rest of the group. And we happened to get there. We were supposed to get there 30 minutes before them. So we were like, great, we'll start grabbing bags. We'll see you all when you get here. We aren't going to be the reason for the delay. I start getting texts as we land from Katrina, who says, hey, we've been delayed in Rwanda. It'll be another hour before we get there.
Okay, fair.
All right, fine. Keep getting texts from Katrina. Hey, we're getting more and more delayed. Hey, we're getting more and more delayed. Okay. She's finally like, why don't you go find Jeff, which is the local surgeon? She was like, you've been there. You know him. You've met him. He will get you guys out of there. You guys don't have to wait for us. Our flight's going to get canceled. So they had given Derek and I equipment bags of just like gauze and some things that they were like, well, you guys are more likely to get delayed than us, so you take the, you know, the lighter, less necessary equipment to have. We'll keep the surgical equipment, the airway equipment, that kind of stuff with us. And you know, we'll get you there. So we had our bags of gauze and who knows what else that we didn't really, you know, necessarily need for anesthesia purposes. And it's midnight and Jeff gets us to the house that we're staying at. And he says, you guys just want to come to the hospital with me tomorrow? Like, you know.
Yeah, why not?
Everyone else is stuck. We're like, yeah, sure. That's what we're here to do. He's like, great. I'll pick you up at 8. Picks us up the next morning. He's like, I'm just going to do a couple little surgeries. Do you guys want to help out? Like, yeah, absolutely. Like, why not? The local team who I had worked with there before, Barbara, has become a good friend to me. She's one of their medical officers. She was there with some of her trainees. Jeff says, I'm just going to do a quick biopsy of this guy's, you know, oral tumor, figure out what it is. And you know, it'll be a quick case. You say, okay.
Whenever I'm hearing these stories, they always start with, oh, it's just going to be a quick case. How many times have we heard that anywhere?
Many, many. Our surgeons say that too. Surgeons don't necessarily understand quick case.
I was just in a 15-minute case that lasted about an hour and a half yesterday.
Right.
So I understand.
Right. And most of the cases we do in Uganda are big flap cases. My longest case there has been 15 and a half hours.
Oh my gosh.
Quite lengthy, but definitely life-changing.
Wow.
But Jeff says this will be a quick case. He saves generally his big giant cases for when his colleagues are there that can help him out and have multiple surgeons in the case.
Sure.
And so we induce this guy, has a normal external airway exam, I should say, as well. Can't see anything of what we're biopsying. So I'm like, okay, it's probably something small. We induce this guy, goes to sleep. He's maskable. It's fine.
Great.
Their team takes a look under DL because that's all they have available. And they're not able to get a view. I notice they start suctioning some blood out of the airway. That's a little weird, but okay. So they look again, can't get a view. So either Derek or I don't remember which one of us first took a look and was like, there's also nothing here. Now there's 400 of blood in the canister.
Oh my gosh. Just from the airway?
Just from the airway, which we have not secured at this point.
Oof.
Luckily, still maskable. Their team goes to push a second dose of sucks because it has been roughly 10 minutes that we are working on this airway at this point. And I had to stop them from A, redosing sucks, and B, I was like, if we can't get this guy's airway, we can't give him more paralytic.
Maybe like, we need him to start breathing again.
We need him to wake up, or, you know, we have to get his airway. So I looked at Jeff, the surgeon, and I said, I need you to trach this man right now. And he's like, what? And I was like, seriously, I need you to trach this man right now. And they open up trach supplies and we masked this man through a trach.
Wow.
And after his trach was in and Jeff was actually able to take a look with his equipment, this man had a giant vesicular tumor, which was the reason we couldn't get a view. And he had a lot of bleeding. But it was a moment that I was like, holy crap, like what would have happened if I wasn't here to say that? And I'm hopeful that things would have gone differently, but I'm not 100% sure they were.
The vesicula, of course, being the area right where you want to put the tip of your blade when you're trying to intubate.
Yeah, yeah, which makes sense as to why he had a normal external airway exam.
Whew, that is scary. So it sounds to me like this was a situation where you made a pretty rapid call that saved somebody's life.
I'm hopeful, yes. And of course, we brought a McGrath and a GlideScope with us, but it was stuck in Rwanda with the rest of the team.
And the other bag, of
exactly.
course. Excellent. So what is it like collaborating with these people like Jeff who work there and are used to that sort of environment? What's the difference between your experiences?
Everyone is typically very laid back in all scenarios. Like even in that scenario, he did not seem like anything was emergent. Like he worked quickly, but you know, it's just like everyone is calm at all times. I think they deal with a lot of these emergencies more frequently than maybe we do and can handle it appropriately. The funny thing is the last time I had been in that same operating room in Uganda with the same team, we left as they were doing an emergency awake trach on that same bed.
Oh, wow.
The patient was wide awake because it was an awake trach respiratory distress and they anticipated difficulty, but the very next time I was back, it was a masked trach, emergency trach, on that same bed. So kind of seeing the flip side of the two scenarios was kind of wild.
So they're very good at handling those sorts of emergency scenarios, at least from the psychological perspective, you'd say.
I think so, yeah.
What are some differences where you notice that maybe our team has a little bit more expertise in?
I think knowing when something is going to go wrong, that anticipation of, you know, this could be bad, where they were going to try again and again to DL when it was clear to me that we weren't getting any sort of view and we're just getting more blood. And eventually probably we're not going to be able to mask this man, that either we were going to have to wake him up or do a trach. And those were going to be our two options. So I just think anticipating those, definitely our airway skills are more advanced. Obviously, we also have more advanced equipment here in the U.S. We at UC here have McGraths and, you know, every OR. So sometimes that's people's default. But they don't have, you know, any of those video equipments that could potentially save them in scenarios such as that.
So you are obviously, to me, an excellent teacher. The residents always really enjoy working with you, learning from you, all these different things. What kind of situations do you get to use your teaching skills over there? Are you passing on some of the knowledge that you have to some of the providers that are over there?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, in Belize, it's more of a doing trip, but we regularly take SRNAs and residents with us on those trips. So they get to see kind of a different environment, different thought processes. We do a pre-op clinic day where, you know, you're screening these patients, but you don't have lab results or echoes or any sort of testing. It's how functional can you be? What do you do for work? You know, do you get chest pain with those kind of things? And you have to make judgment calls based off of that. So it's a different environment for the residents and SRNAs that we take with us to learn.
So we don't just get to send them for their cardiology consult.
Unfortunately, no.
Get a full $1 million workout.
Unfortunately, no. But it tends to work out just fine. So, you know. And then in Africa, there's a lot of teaching opportunity. They bring trainees to the hospitals where they have groups coming in, knowing that they're going to have that opportunity for educational learning. And a lot of my teaching, I like to do just about whatever scenario we're in, because I think it's the easiest to learn in that modality if you can relate it to something that you're doing. But we've talked about doing more formal education programs with the Uganda curriculum as we get there and topics that they are interested in. With blocks for me and Josh that frequently goes is critical care trained. So he has a lot to teach as well. And in Ghana, which I'm hopeful to go back to at some point as well with the Azra trip, I've been talking to one of the coordinators there. They're very interested in learning regional pain and even chronic pain things. They actually have somebody that's doing a fellowship in just pain, which is acute and chronic there, to learn all the procedural stuff. And she's been teaching everyone things that she learns from everybody else. So it's really cool to see the kind of do one, see one, teach one method throughout the process. They even have a program through the World Society of Federation of Anesthesia, I think WSFA, I think that's the correct acronym, where they send trainees from other countries in Africa to this hospital in Ghana to learn regional because they have so much exposure through Azra.
Azra being?
The American Society of Regional Anesthesia. Thank you.
Just for my audience who may not be as aware of the acronym soup.
That's fair.
As you and I have gotten more accustomed to.
Fair.
What about ultrasound availability? Is that something that you have access to, that they have access to there? Are you bringing something handheld? How does that all work?
It really depends where you're at. The hospital in Ghana that regularly does their own regional procedures and is building this fellowship and has people come train, they do have an ultrasound. It is one of the, I think it's a Sonosite, either M Turbo or M Max, which doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, but it's one of those ones that like flips open like a laptop and is kind of old school for a lot of places here. But they have one of those readily available. That is the only hospital that I've ever been to internationally that has their own ultrasound.
Wow.
The hospital I went to in Uganda for my regional trip had told us they were regularly using ultrasound and regularly doing blocks. So I thought, great, we'll be able to, you know, build on that. Turns out they were regularly doing blocks, but had never seen an ultrasound before. So they were doing landmark-based anatomical blocks, but had never seen an ultrasound before. So luckily, Research International, the group that I had went through, had sent an ultrasound with us just in case, which was actually the same ultrasound that I found in Ghana, which I thought was kind of coincidental. But we had to teach them how to use an ultrasound and how to find a needle and all of that kind of stuff. So I went, had a colleague go down to the market and bought chicken breast, and we started playing with needles and ultrasound on the chicken block, chicken breast, before we started poking on patients.
Yeah, it's definitely good to block a chicken breast before you start on the patients themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
So when you left, though, the ultrasound probably also went away too, right?
Unfortunately, yeah.
So how do you make sure when you're doing all this teaching and telling people how to do the latest and greatest thing, how do you make sure that your efforts are having a lasting impact?
Yeah, a lot of that is figuring out what equipment they have available and how to use the equipment they readily have access to. Obviously, donations are great, but they're not necessarily sustainable unless it's a continuous donation pipeline. From a just resources standpoint, talking to OB, the fellow in Ghana, they didn't have block needles there. She was like, yeah, sometimes we get them when, you know, people come through and do this kind of stuff, but it's not something we can easily and affordably get. So I asked her, you know, what they typically use for doing their blocks. And the answer was an IV needle, an 18 gauge for adults and 20 gauge for children.
Wow.
Because that's what they readily and cheaply have access to, where you and I would never think of doing a block with an IV needle, not only because A, that's a larger size than we're used to using. It's not a blunt tip needle, you know, just different things that from a safety perspective, but that is their norm. And that's what they train with because that's what they can reliably get and use.
Right. You worry about things like cutting through nerves and all that sort of stuff. You'd have to be a lot more careful.
Right. So just, I was like, oh, I've never thought of doing that, but that's, you know, their norm. So just kind of adapting to teach with the equipment they can readily and easily use, is one of the things that can be helpful. And then figuring out, especially if you're going to go back to somewhere regularly, you can figure out what they need. In Uganda, one of the local anesthesiologists has her own like pocket butterfly that she will use for blocks, but that's her personal equipment.
Sure.
So it just kind of depends. Some people are willing to, you know, spend some of their, you know, hard earned money for these things, and other places are not. So it just kind of depends, you know, either building a fund to donate money to get them the equipment that they need, or bringing things that you can leave behind. I know Josh has actually found multiple things on eBay that we have left in Uganda that he has generously, you know, paid for out of his own pocket, an Entitle CO2 monitor being one of those things that he found on eBay because we didn't have Entitle monitoring in Uganda.
Entitle monitoring is one of those things that is very important to an anesthesiologist.
Yeah.
I can imagine that it probably makes a big difference to them.
Yeah. So, you know, a couple $100, he was, you know, able to donate that and leave, you know, that. We were able to teach them how to appropriately use it and what the numbers meant and all of that kind of stuff, where it's something that they didn't regularly see, but here it's one of our standards of monitoring. So.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that I guess you more often think about in the context of the history of anesthesia, mm-hmm. is when they started adding things like pulse ox and Entitle CO2 to make sure that we can keep our patients safe. But when you are going somewhere like you've been with very limited resources, I guess you can't necessarily take that stuff for granted.
Yeah.
So what other memorable moments do you have from your experience taking these trips?
That's such a broad question, John. I have many.
I know. And I've heard you tell a lot of these stories before, but I just really enjoy every time you come back hearing all the new stories that you have.
I think one of my most just memorable patient stories was my first trip to Uganda. We had a 17-year-old who came in for a head and neck camp. He had a tumor on his face. he had told everyone that he was 21 because he was still 17 and could not technically consent for himself, but he had been largely disowned by his family because of this tumor. He had stopped going to school because he had been made fun of so frequently. And it was very disfiguring. It was mostly on his maxilla, kind of in his nose and cheek region. But it's very, you know, scary looking whenever you just see it in general. So Jeff had saved this case knowing that the team was coming, that it was going to be a big procedure. And he had told this kid that he would, you know, help him out as best we could. So seeing his airway for the first time, I was still a resident on this trip. I was like, holy crap, this is terrifying. What do we do? And I, you know, I wish I could show pictures and things on a podcast, but makes it a little tough, in this modality. But we did a, you know, very thorough airway exam and actually found out he had a great mouth opening. It was just all maxilla. He was a grade one view whenever you actually took a look, at his Mallampati score but he was not going to be maskable. So we had to come up with a plan where we could, you know, either rapid sequence intubate or keep him spontaneously breathing until we figured out exactly what we needed to do airway wise. And luckily his airway, you know, wasn't that terrifying. It all ended up going very well. He had a 12 plus hour surgery where they created a flap and removed this mass. And unfortunately his flap failed the first day. So we had to bring him back to the operating room for a second 12 hour procedure from a flap for the second day. So this guy had, you know, two 12 plus hour general anesthetics back to back. But his second flap luckily took. He had a trach for about 3 months and then they were able to decannulate him as he healed and is now back to living, you know, a normal life. Luckily, whenever they sent the tumor to pathology, it was a non-cancerous, just rapidly growing benign tumor. So he doesn't have to worry about, you know, a malignant cancer happening there. But definitely a life-changing story and something that I was like, holy crap, how does this even happen? Kind of moment.
Those sort of moments, I imagine, make it all seem worth it when you can make that big of a difference to somebody who otherwise would have had a totally different outcome to their lives.
Absolutely. And when I had talked to him like beforehand and even after, he said he wanted to be a doctor after all of this. And like, he was a very smart kid, but he had, you know, stopped going to school because he was being made fun of and bullied. But now that he, you know, is back to living a normal life, he can, you know, go and get the education and that kind of stuff. So I'm hopeful to one day see him when I'm over there as a physician.
Well, I look forward to reading his personal statement if he applies to our program. he can probably name drop you. If somebody were in the early phases of their career, about to become a resident, or maybe they're a resident already, and they think that what you are talking about sounds amazing, incredible, and that's a direction they want to go with their career, what recommendations do you have for them?
Definitely let people know you're interested. It's one of those things that a lot of global health stuff happens by word of mouth. I constantly get people reaching out to me, both other, you know, attendings from other places that I've worked with, saying like, hey, what connections you have? What do you know? What can I do? Or what programs can we grow? Just letting people know you're interested. I know when I interviewed for residency here and Mike had talked about the Belize trip, I was like, I am interested. I want to do that. It's part of the reason that I was interested in, you know, this program. And Mike knew from the day one of me being an intern that I was going to Belize and I was not going to have it any other way as a CA3. And then COVID happened and it almost ruined it, but we got to go. But just letting people know you're interested, seeing what opportunities are available. There's a lot of different groups that go all over the world that are big groups, both anesthesia as well as surgical and just even medical wise. A lot of it's kind of doing your own research or finding out who knows what in whatever area you're in. Mike redirects a lot of people to me now, which is totally fine. But I've made a lot of contacts through him. And that's also how I got involved in Uganda. You know, Josh was like, hey, who's interested? And I immediately jumped on it. And now I've got to go back a couple of times So just letting people know you're interested when those things come up, you know, things get sent your way, and somehow it ends up working out.
That's fantastic. What about any societies that you recommend joining or being a part of that have maybe been of help to you? What do you think about that?
I joined the ASRA, again, the Anesthesia Society of Regional Anesthesia. They have a global health special interest group. I joined that. So they have a lot of little updates here and there. They have a couple of different trips that go various places throughout the world. So I'm trying to get a little bit more involved in one of those. And then actually one of our colleagues here is trying to get his, Brian's trying to get his Tanzania trip. I think he actually has it recognized by ASRA now.
Oh, that's great.
So creating more opportunities out there. And his is primarily a education-based trip in one of the hospitals in Tanzania. So just getting involved like that, even if it's, you know, doing a virtual lecture at first, trying to, you know, get involved with that hospital and then seeing what connections you can make. If you're willing to do a lot of legwork, there's definitely a lot of opportunities. If you want something that's already a little more established, there's definitely a lot of those things out there too.
So could you briefly talk about the opportunities that our residents have if they were doing a residency here, towards one of those trips?
Yeah, absolutely. So here at UC, we take usually three CA3s every year to Belize with us. That number can be flexed just kind of depending on how many trips there are and different things. The group that we go to Belize with typically goes twice a year for at least 3 weeks among those trips. So we definitely have availability if we have enough staff to cover those trips for the residents. There's usually a couple of residents, if not more, that want to go on those trips. So we have to figure out who has the time and availability to spend some of their elective time doing that. And then we also take residents on the Uganda trip as well. Usually just one, just because it's a smaller trip overall, and it's a lot farther and more difficult to get to. And oftentimes 10 to 14 days. So it's a little bit longer of a time commitment and a little bit more of a money commitment. But, you know, we help our residents with some of the funding and the opportunity and giving them the information that they need to make those decisions. And it's always a very positive feedback from the residents that get to go. So I would love to be able to take all of them if they all show interest.
And it's something that counts as real rotation time, right?
It does. We have it approved through the ACGME as a recognized rotation for CA3s. We just submit a thing every year for the ones that are going to get it approved for them. And it's seemingly a pretty seamless process at this point, but definitely something that can be done for a lot of global health trips at other institutions with a little bit of legwork as well.
So what kind of advice would you give to somebody who's just about to take their first global trip?
Be ready to be adaptable and troubleshoot and be prepared for everything. I know that seems silly, but it's one of those things that you just never know what's going to happen. I remember the first trip I ever did. Me and Mary and Chris were in the white van on the way up to the hospital, and Mike was going through emergency scenarios with us and said, if this happens, what are you going to do? If this happens, what are you going to do? And one of his scenarios was, if the power goes out, what are you going to do? You know, the power goes out here and the generator kicks on.
Right.
Power goes out there. It's not a generator to kick on. And we were all like, oh, that's not going to happen. Lo and behold, happens to me.
Excellent. So you're already working with unfamiliar equipment in a situation where you've never been in. Taking care of somebody's life is in your hands. And the power goes out. What are you feeling in that moment?
Oh, crap. But, you know, a little more explicit, I think.
Thank you for sanitizing it for the podcast audience.
Luckily, you know, Mike had run through this. You know, I think I would have been able to think through it just a little, you know, slower, probably, if we hadn't already talked about it. Luckily for me, it was an ENT surgery where they had some headlights on, so the room wasn't totally pitch black, but it is a room without windows. So, you know, if there were no headlights, it would have been pitch black. I also popped on the light on my cell phone, my flashlight, and just laid it so that it was flashing up. Luckily, the other OR had just extubated and was rolling to PACU when this happened. So at least their patient was no longer under general, but obviously still needed monitors. And switched over to an Ambu bag and was drawing up some propofol. And Mary ran in and said, what can I do? So I handed her the propofol and said, I don't know, start being an infusion pump.
assign Mary as the infusion pump, and you got to squeeze the bag. So you guys became the anesthesia machine.
Correct. And then last year, John Latrimoy and I were there, and I briefly ran through said scenario with him, and it happened to him.
It sounds like this is actually a pretty high yield scenario to run through.
Yeah, it turns out. I think those are the only two occurrences that I know for sure it's happened. And luckily it wasn't a long power outage. It felt like it was forever, but in reality it was a couple of minutes.
Okay, so it's something where the power did come back on, you were able to turn everything back on and it resolved.
Yes, but you don't know, you know, when it happens. Apparently one of them was a planned power outage that no one had told us about.
You just didn't think to put planned power outage as part of your anesthesia plan.
Right.
Well, next time maybe you can consider that.
So now it's a scenario that is high yield to run through for the residents going this year. If you guys are listening, go ahead and plan for that.
Oh, excellent. So let's back up a little. I'd love to hear some of the style points that have helped make you more successful in your life and career.
You know, I think just being able to be adaptable, being able to work with whoever you're working with in whatever scenarios you're working with is important. You know, there's some people that are very rigid and probably aren't the right people to do these kind of trips. The other thing is just being friendly and social and communicating can go a long way. Building relationships and having people trust you and know who you are and coming into an area that you're not necessarily familiar with is super helpful. I now have, you know, WhatsApp messages going with, you know, Barbara and patients and some of the other people in Uganda, and I'm Facebook friends with some of the people in Belize. So, you know, just kind of keeping that rapport going back to the same locations, you know, being willing to help and being adaptable and doing whatever they need you to do. Sometimes it's not just doing anesthesia. Sometimes it's, you know, helping with a pre-op IV that they're having trouble getting. Sometimes it's scrubbing because they need somebody in the OR to scrub and we have an extra person. So just kind of being adaptable and ready to do anything and friendly and willing to take whatever role you need to take goes a long way.
Well, when I think of the people on my short list of having high adaptability and emotional intelligence and being friendly, you are close to the top of that list. So thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Thanks for joining us for this month's episode of Style Points. If you found yourself particularly interested in the topic of this episode, Erica has offered to share her email address with anyone who is interested in global health. For that, or if you have any other thoughts, please email me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com, and I would be happy to send that to you. I genuinely appreciate everyone who has taken time out of their day to listen to the podcast. If you really enjoyed it, leave a 5-star rating or a review and share it with your friends. Lastly, take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.